Well, I don't have my donut prepared, but let's put on the cans as Ethan rides the fader. That's right, it's the jargon edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, what's in a name? Body bombs, pre-infected electronics, musings on Russian leaders, and jargon. Let's start episode 123.
You're trying to sleep, being fair. When there's something to share, being neat. When you're folding a sheet. That's mathematics. When a ball bounces off of a wall. When you cook from a recipe book. When you know how much money you owe. That's mathematics. How much gold can you hold in an elephant's ear? When it's noon on the moon, then what time is it here? If you could count for a year, would you get to infinity or somewhere in that vicinity? When you choose how much postage to use, when you know what's the chance it will snow, when you bet and you end up in debt. Oh, try as you may.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Dawn, your political science philosopher.
I'm Jenna, your resident biochemist.
So how's everybody this week?
Depressed.
Depressed.
So depressed.
Oh, Don.
Yeah, I know.
Say it ain't so.
Well, apparently, humanity, civilization as we know it, ceases to exist this week. It is the last flight of the U.S. space shuttle. And as we all know, just as the Visigoths going over the hill towards Rome, it marked the end of civilization as they knew it then. We as in the United States and Canada, as the leech that we are in the United States, are no longer capable of going into space anymore. And that just seems sad.
I don't know if the Canadian space community appreciates being called a leech.
I'm not sure if the Canadian community at large appreciates being called a leech.
Oh, yeah, and that was the most important part of my little thing there, was the fact we no longer can go into space, at least not us as in North America.
Well, have you guys noticed, though, that all the complaining and all the talk I've heard about the end of this sort of the space shuttle era seems to be that they're... More people are complaining about the fact that America is not going to be leading the space race anymore, as opposed to they're not going to have a presence in space anymore. It seems more about nationalism than it does about science.
Yes, but we are all Americans, aren't we?
No.
Okay. Anyone who knows me knows how odd it would be for me to say that for real. But no, you're right. I mean, India has its space program. China is supposed to be in the next year or two a manned mission into space.
As well as the European Space Agency. And I assume Russia is going to continue their...
Well, but again...
Oh, those cosmonauts.
But let's remember, at the moment, Russia is the only country that actually does have the capacity to send people into space.
Yes. I mean, until NASA comes up with a replacement for the shuttle, which could be who knows how many years off. After all, they're kind of in debt right now. One of the big problems with the shuttle was that it was so expensive. I've always been a bit skeptical of the shuttle program myself. I don't know. It's the fact that of the six shuttles that were in use, two of them had catastrophic failures that killed 14 people. I'm kind of skeptical this was ever really a viable system or a long-term system at the most. But
if you use historical parallels, I believe that the three ships that Christopher Columbus went to America with, only one actually made it back.
Yes.
So we are improving.
Improving the percentage.
Improving
sure.
A little bit, yes.
Actually, it was funny. One of the articles that I was reading this week was commenting on how much better designed and safer the Russian version, the Soviet version, was of the shuttle. Like everyone knows the Soviets went over and they kind of stole the whole shuttle idea and they built one of their own, which is like just a clone. But I guess they apparently did it better. But to be fair, it never flew that many times and it was sort of an oddball. But such is life.
Let's jinx.
Okay.
If you ask me, the biggest loss, as sort of Ethan was saying, is not necessarily so huge for science. I think it's a big loss for biology. I mean, these are the best human guinea pigs we had going. There's no way for us to do super low gravity experiments on Earth, and getting some North Americans up there was just increasing the biologic diversity of the sample.
Well, we still have the International Space Station.
Yeah, but without the North Americans, we don't have a full representation of the genetic sort of variation of people living at different parts of the planet.
Well, it's also one of those things where you put all your eggs into one basket, right? I mean, theoretically, we had the American and the Russian capacity to get up to space station. If something had gone wrong, you had two. Now you just have the one. If something happens to the Russians' capacity to get up there in space, there is no plan B.
Well, right? there are the privately owned space companies.
Which none of them have actually proven themselves. I mean, all of them are kind of on the way, but none of them are actually there yet.
Yeah.
And actually, just to show you how worried NASA and the space agencies are, from what I understand, the last shuttle mission was just crammed full of food. That was the biggest thing that they had carried up there, was food, because they were worried that they just might not be able to resupply the people who are up there. Which, just, you got to sit back and wonder what it's like to be on the International Space Station right now when you see the last cab to Earth leave and going, I'm sure there'll be another one. You know, it's like, I don't know, it's like you're 1 or 2 in the morning and you see the bus go off in the distance and you just missed it and you're going, I'm sure there's more buses, right? Yeah, there's a night bus. Yeah, the night bus is going to come by. I'm not going to have to walk 5 miles home, which, of course, for the shuttle people in the space station, it's a bit more than 5 miles, but a little warm, too, on reentry. But.
Well, maybe aliens will rescue them.
Or at least feed them.
Or eat them.
Yes, which is a form of feeding, but the wrong end of it.
Yeah. So, Don.
Speaking of the wrong end of things.
Very nice.
Hitler is getting kicked on again. I mean, this landmark historical figure of the 20th century just cannot get a fair break. Probably because he was really bad person. Hitler's hometown apparently is revoking his honorary citizenship. The Austrian town of Brno, Hitler's birthplace, apparently, has revoked the Nazi dictator's honorary citizenship. Although, in fact, he never actually had one from that town. The town that actually he was born in was called Ranshofen, which was incorporated into the Brno in 1939. So, technically, he didn't actually have it. But the city council voted unanimously to strip him of all honorary titles that he may have. Because this is obviously a very pressing issue in Germany right now with the rise of Hitlerism and such.
Why now? Like,
yeah, I was going to say, Hitler's a pressing issue
through
now?
The town chart. Wait a second. What's this?
Yeah, no, actually, that was...
they
that
got
was,
a new clerk.
he was apparently made an honorary citizen, like I say, of Ranshofen, but then he wasn't really honorary because that's where he was born, apparently, right? So I don't quite understand, yeah, why now? But there is an interesting parallel that's going on here in Canada right now. In another news article titled, Aboriginals Jubilant as Halifax School Deletes Cornwallis from Name. Recently in Halifax, a school has removed the name Cornwallis because it offended the Misquia people of the area. Apparently Cornwallis, although Edward Cornwallis is considered to be one of the founders of Halifax, he issued in the 1750s a bounty on the scalps of any natives, which he referred to as, quote, savages, in response to the natives attacking European settlements, to which, of course, the Micmac, sorry, that's the right pronunciation this time, the Micmac were notably, don't think of him as a very great person and Canadian history, and were somewhat offended that his name would be applied to this school. So, of course, I have a couple of thoughts in this matter. I mean, one, as we talked about with the Hitler one, I mean, does it really matter? The events in questions are not really relevant to our current society. They are long historical events, and so why should we really bother and sort of judge up this stuff? Second, and this is pertinent, I think, in the case of Cornwallis, is that although it may be true that, you know, what he did was a horrible thing, but in the context of the time, it wasn't that out of place. I mean, it was a common practice of natives to use scalping. The Europeans that came to Canada and the United States were quite willing to, you know, latch onto this and use the natives in their own political machinations. So again, you know, there's this whole using modern morality on in a historical content. I mean, is it really fair? And lastly, is the whole idea that if we discovered, let's say, Einstein was a pedophile, or that Jesus supported slavery, or something weird like that, does that mean that we have to treat the person completely as a pariah, just because one aspect of their life may have been unsavory, although perhaps in the grander scheme of things, their influence was quite remarkable and quite positive to society in general?
Now, Don, it might shock you.
Uh-oh.
But I think I'm going to argue with you. Firstly, just, you know, so we're all clear, Einstein was actually a pretty prolific womanizer, but, you know, just added a little color to his character. But I think, aside, completely opposite to the idea that maybe we shouldn't think of these things that happened in the past, seeing as how they're not relevant, or depending on who you ask, the exact things happening in our societies today, I think that there's the question of sweeping these types of things under the rug. So an important historical persona did something wrong, and we don't really want to lie and say it didn't happen. So instead we lie and say, oh no, he had nothing to do with us. We were way over there when it happened. And he didn't, you know, found our group or our school. No. He had nothing to do with us.
Sure.
And I think that it's hard to sort of learn from the mistakes that people make in the past if all we do is disassociate ourselves from their actions.
So maybe then you do kind of agree with me, even though I'm going to disagree with your disagreement. Because isn't by, you know, wiping the name of Cornwallis from the school, from whatever records, sort of trying to say it didn't happen, it wasn't us, it's putting it underneath the carpet. Whereas to have the name on the school, to say, okay, this person was important to the founding of Halifax, we should also be aware of, at the same time, that he was not a perfect person, that he did this, which would lead into the other aspect that, well, he did this, did he do that because he was a horrible person? You go, no, actually, this was sort of a common thing that Europeans did when they came over here, and in which case it actually becomes a tool to explore our history and to facilitate greater understanding of both then and now, how much things have changed, how much more maybe needs to be changed.
Yes, I think we do actually, in fact, agree and just express ourselves differently, because that's exactly what I'm trying to say. By, you know, wiping a name off or revoking a citizenship, I don't think it's being beneficial for that society in the long run at all, because what you going to learn?
I think actually we did an episode a while ago, Ethan was sort of spearheading it, about the whole idea of heroism, right? And I think that is sort of a bad thing in society, where you sit there and you create this sort of aura of omnipotence on a particular historical figure.
Einstein. And sorry.
And that's a bad thing. Actually, right now, the big one, if you look online, I believe there are a whole bunch of series of cartoons about Ronald Reagan and how he just cured every problem in the world when he was around, and he was the white Superman. But it's the idea that, you know, we can appreciate and we can sort of praise particular ideas or actions of individuals and praise those things without saying that this individual himself was somehow beyond criticism, was somehow a hero that should be worshipped in toto.
Well, speaking of worshipping heroes, did you guys know that the Prime Minister of Russia, Vladimir Putin, was sent by God to help his country?
You know, Ethan, we've talked about this before. What is your obsession with Putin? I mean, how many times have you talked about how you think you should... Well, okay, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. No, I hadn't heard.
Well, Don, that's what one of the chief political strategists of the Kremlin said on Friday. To quote him, "I honestly believe that Putin is a person who was sent to Russia by fate and by the Lord at a difficult time for Russia." This was said by Vladislav Surkov, a staunch Putin supporter and one of Russia's most powerful men. And he was quoted by the Interfax news agency on the state-run Chechnyan TV. Further to add to that quote, "Putin was preordained by fate to preserve our peoples." So these comments by Surkov, who served in the Kremlin under Putin throughout his presidency and his prime minister-isms, sort of refers to this cult of personality that's been building around Putin ever since he was president, and it seems to be building up ahead of a presidential election coming up in 2012, which Putin has been quite coy on if he will run. And I think it actually would break Russian law if he did run. I think that's why he became prime minister few years ago.
Yeah, I think that's where the minutia is, because there are term limits for the presidency, but it's the difference between whether you can run for two terms, period, or two consecutive terms.
Ah, okay. Well, that might be the interesting key here. Now, another sort of, as I was looking at this story, another sort of thing that popped out to me was that about 2 months ago, a nun-like sect appeared in central Russia claiming that Putin was a saint and savior and tried to get him anointed as a saint. And then a spokesperson for Putin says that he doesn't approve of that kind of admiration. So some kind of admiration, like getting a song written about you, is okay, but being revered as a saint is a bit too much.
Well, by nun groupies?
Well, it's funny, though, because we've mentioned on the show that, I mean, Putin is not someone who shies away from positive press, right? I mean, he's quite famous as someone who released a calendar of Putin with him and, you know, fighting fires and busheling hay around and
taking his shirt off and fishing.
Taking a harpoon and killing a whale, I think, was one of the ones that we had in there.
Starring in Old Spice commercials.
Exactly. You know, what I find really interesting here is sort of the historical echo, right? One of the things everyone has always accused atheists is that, you know, atheists are not necessarily moral people. Look at the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was an atheist society, and look at all the horrible things it did. But to be fair, the Soviet Union was not Christian-type religious, but they did have the cult of personality. That was one of the things that was kind of common amongst all the big communist society, whereas where they would deify the party leader. And it strikes me as well, apropos, although scary, that seems to be what's happening with Putin.
Yeah, and he's really sort of bumped up the Orthodox Church as the, you know, state religion, and he's really put a lot of power into the church. He's made it a very clear alliance that he's with, which has actually really upset a lot of the country's minority religions, like Muslims and non-Orthodox Christians, who say that it's undermining Russia's secular constitution. And, you know, as you said, in the Soviet Union, the church was against the rules, and they had sort of state religion. It was kind of a worship of the Soviet Union. Now it appears that the Orthodox Church is really kind of taking that place. And then in addition to this, I think we've talked about in the past, some of the other disturbing anti-skeptical trends in Russia. Remember, listeners will recall that a year or so we talked about Stalin's grandson who was suing a newspaper for defamation of his family honor. And in addition, there's been this sort of growth of nostalgia for Stalin. He even placed third in a national poll on who was the greatest Russian. So it is a bit odd that you're seeing this kind of resurrection of cult of personality, as well as a decrease in sort of skeptical, secular emotion in Russia right now. Any comments?
Yes. Actually, if you want to see some really out there sort of news reporting from Russia, is if you look at Russia Today. They were famous recently for having a woman on there explaining that a missile attack on California was actually thwarted by aliens who were trying to protect the United States and actually destroyed the missile before it could actually... And this was a quote-unquote serious news article on Russia Today, and I just went, okay. So if you look at Russia Today, I mean, they're all over the gambit, right? They do have some things that I think qualify as real news, but they are not afraid to go out there in the land of woo. A interesting piece of jargon.
Yes. Well, more on jargon later in the show. Let's go to a commercial break and we'll be back with more here on CITR.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Picture called The Big Trail. Well, I've made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days,
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that
CITR
can be mighty helpful.
Yeah!
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will net you discounts downtown at 212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, Heart and Soul Clothing Incorporated, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinema Tech, Scratch Records, True Value Vintage, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So, Don, what's this I hear about terrorism from the inside?
Yes, yes. Terrorism apparently is internalizing its struggle. A new terrorist threat apparently are undetectable surgically implanted bombs. As we may or may not know, there's an ongoing game between security forces and those who wish to upset society, a game called Hide and Go Boom. In recent years, we have seen security go from, you know, watchful guards, bag search, medical detectors, the pat-down, and most lately, the evasive body scanners. After each improvement in security, the other side, a group we now collectively call terrorists, find a way around it. The latest pushback, apparently, is a news report that terrorists are now planning to implant explosive inside bombers, something that only X-ray detectors or similar type technology could hope to detect. These stories appear to be traced back to Department of Homeland Security agent who reportedly said that the Department of Homeland Security has identified a potential threat from terrorists who may surgically implant explosives or explosive components in humans to conduct terrorist attacks. In fact, some security advisors, analysts, suspect that actually it was a rectum bomb that was responsible for an assassination in Saudi Arabia, I think it was last year.
Something tells me that they really shouldn't have released this information, or as I like to call it, idea, publicly.
Well, there's an interesting aspect to that, which we'll get into a little bit later. But my thoughts on this actually are twofold. One,
The first fold
is that we can never be 100% secure. In fact, I doubt we could even be 90% secure, for those who may be pedantic on the word 100. And at some point, we have to say that although it may be possible for a loss of life, the cost of preventing it is so extreme as to be prohibitive. A great example of this is that, you know, we probably lose as many people in 9/11, Americans lost 9/11, every day due to car accidents. And we find this somewhat acceptable. But we do so because if we had spent the money on cars and the traffic system in order to prevent this, in order to make it so it's almost impossible to die in a car accident, cars could only be afforded by billionaires.
Or unless you have some kind of Minority Report-style tracks that cars could only travel on.
Exactly. And so you have the point that, you know, yes, there may be, even if we said, you know, there's a 9/11 attack every year in the United States, horrible loss of life, would not want to be one of those people. But the cost that the American society has and the rest of the world by osmosis, not only the financial cost, but the loss of liberty, loss of freedom, the ever-pervasive sense of terror that is around, right? Those are huge expenses that, you know, again, does it justify?
Well, and I don't think the issue is just only does it justify, but is it even effective? I mean, some kind of to say that there's an acceptable level of risk sort of presupposes that we have the choice of removing that risk entirely. But I'm not really convinced that we have that choice. So a very dear friend of mine who shall remain nameless is very, very, very fond of reinforcing deadbolts and reinforcing locks and replacing hinges because, you know, they're worried about people breaking in. But really, although a certain level of this kind of activity is quite prudent, like you want your bars on your downtown businesses and whatnot on the windows, you have to understand that you're not really ever going to keep out the people who really, really, really want in. The only people you're keeping out are the people that, you know, it'd be easy to get in. And as far as coming up with new ways of concealing bombs and whatnot after 9/11, people were consulting people in the film industry for ideas about what to do. So the human imagination, I personally have never seen any kind of containment for where it can stretch, and that's just about as far as you can come up with new ideas to cause terror.
Well, you know, and that plays into the second sort of fold I had on this, is that, you know, that a number of the institutions involved in this, Department of Homeland Security, CSIS here in Canada, they actually this perpetuation of this climate of fear. I mean, one of the ways that they discovered from my readings, and this is a little which came first, chicken or the egg, is that they are actually actively engaged in, like, chat rooms and talk rooms, and they're saying, hey, are any surgeons out there interested in implanting bombs in a terrorist? And you know, once you throw that idea out there,
everybody's got
someone says, "Hey, that's not a bad idea." But I mean, it's one of the things that was a big issue in the United States is this idea of entrapment. Is at what point, when you're trying to investigate potential terrorist threats, do you actually start becoming the source of these terrorist threats in itself? Now, like I say, you know, institutions like to perpetuate this sort of sense of fear. I mean, obviously, beyond the corporations, which everyone knows how much I love, which are now, of course, developing expensive equipment to detect these internal bombs. And I couldn't help but notice that in a large number of the stories that I had read, their names were mentioned quite prominently in there, which, of course, serves them both, because now they're going to the go-to person when it comes to security agencies to buy these. Plus, it doesn't help your share price. But above and beyond that, it's interesting that a lot of the stories that I've been reading lately are from American news agencies. And of course, as we've sort of hinted at before with the space agency, currently the U.S. government is facing basically a budgetary catastrophe. One of the key themes in this is cutting government spending. So if you were an American agency, let's say Homeland Security, Transportation Security Agency, or the CIA, and you're worried that your budget might be cut, it might be within your own self-interest to sort of make sure that everyone knows that there are imminent threats out there, and that when the politicians think about this, they will remember that the value of their dollar spent in these agencies are maybe worth it, and they're less likely to get cut.
Mm-hmm. And the other point I'd add to that is we can sort of take that to mean that they're sort of like these malicious sort of money-grubbing jerks, but they may have bought in to their own mythology. And, you know, you talk to people who are in sort of the business of intelligence and security, they usually wholeheartedly believe they're doing the right thing and that there actually is a guy in the bushes waiting to get you around every corner. So from their point of view, they might be doing a wonderful thing. And I think it's important to remember that there's not always malice behind these sort of security measures, but simply a lack of critical thinking, which is why I think we need to get more sort of skeptics and critical thinkers inside these organizations and informing politicians and policymakers about why you can't have 100% security really ever, and that you have to sort of realize that human error and, you know, jerks who are going to blow up planes are always going to exist, and you have to find ways to minimize their impact, but you can't assume that you're going to be able to solve this problem by throwing money at it.
Yeah, no, and I would reiterate that I don't think that most of these are conspiratory in nature,
mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the systems are set up to actually make it easier to go down these particular roads just because of the way our society is particularly set up.
You know?
Not evil, just human.
Yeah. Well, humans can be evil.
Yeah. Maybe if the alien terrorists come in, we can get rid of the human factor.
Yes.
Then we won't have to worry about the Hitlers.
Yeah. Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back to talk about jargon.
You bet.
Jargon is awesome.
I imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, action. Wizard, you shall not pass! Cut! Sir Ian.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables.
Beep, 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 beep
I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
We're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Jenna, you're involved in the scientific community.
Sure, I am.
You're a scientist and all that jazz. But sometimes all this science talk goes over my head. But that's completely by accident, right? They're not trying to do that, are they?
Well, it really depends who's talking at you. Hmm. But no, there's definitely some language issues in many areas of life, and science just happens to be one of the places where it's most obvious. So I think, personally, and you guys can let me know what you think, that there's definitely something in the old worn-out quote that the pen is mightier than the sword. So, I mean, today we might adapt that in our digital age to say the podcast is mightier than the handgun, which may be a bit of a hyperbole, but the meaning behind it is essentially the same. So what, of course, we're talking about here is the power of language. And this is something I feel really strongly about, that language is an immutable trait of the human condition. And one could really argue that it's the single most important trait in defining our species and, absolutely, I would argue, our societies. So people who are deprived of acquiring language, like those who are born congenitally deaf, who don't have the proper support systems in either their communities or their parents, are actually, unable to acquire language, and they develop a completely different brain physiology in many areas. And it actually hinders acquiring different skills that would seem on the surface to be separate from language and hearing. And so I just bring up this point to say that language is so intrinsic to what we are that depriving someone of being able to acquire language changes the whole way that their brain works.
So, well, I was reading your notes about that. For example?
For heaven's sakes. Don, I read this book a year ago and I forget. But
I think some obvious ones is our ability to socialize, because communication is just an obvious facilitator of socialization.
Right, and that would be one of the things that superficially would actually seem to be involved in language and with hearing and stuff. Obviously, if you can't hold a conversation, it is hard to socialize. But even things like, I'm making a guess and I might be wildly wrong, but for an example, either mathematic ability or spatial reasoning and that kind of thing can actually be affected by the brain physiology that comes about by from the effects of being deprived of language. And so the point I'm trying to make is that this tool that we use that we think is a product of our brains actually helps contribute to building our brains and is a really important thing of who we are. So the power of our ideas that's expressed through language has really been the most important force in directing the course of human history, and now even arguably human evolution, especially as we move forward. So something that I think gets lost in this general concept sometimes is that the power of language doesn't lie in just the idea alone. Of course, we use language to express our ideas, but the very specific words that we use to get that point across can be just as powerful. So a really inspiring idea I'm not going to say absolute truth because I'm a scientist, but, you know, a powerful truth can become completely lost if the language that's used to express it is not effective. And not just effective in and of itself, but to the specific audience that's the target for that information. So also related to this idea is that the power of some words is actually to disguise the true nature of an idea or to disguise its intent. So sometimes this can be intentional and sometimes unintentional, but either way, the result is that people can be misled or powerfully alienated by the language that we use. So one type of language that can be intrinsically misleading or more often simply incomprehensible is jargon. So jargon is defined in the dictionary, I looked it up. See, this one I looked up today. Is a vocabulary which is meaningful only to a particular profession or group. So today we'll mostly be talking about those in the scientific community. So as we'll explore, this in and of itself is not really a problem, and it can even be incredibly useful. But the problem arises when the group that the words are directed to are completely sort of unintelligible or gibberish or misleading to from the people that actually understand the words that are coming out of their mouths.
There's also the added factor that a number of technical scientific words have crossed over and do have genuine meaning in the real world. One of the best examples, I think, is the idea of quantum.
I would argue that they also have, quote, genuine meaning in the scientific world, but
No, I agree. But when you refer to quantum in its original scientific sense, you tend to mean really, really small. When you use the word quantum in a more cultural, social context, it tends to mean absolutely huge, you know?
Absolutely, and as we'll talk about a little bit, it can go the other way as well. Often, groups will actually co-opt terms that already have English definitions and then redefine them in a jargony way, and it's that kind of language that can really be used to mislead people who think that they're understanding the words that they're hearing. So it can go either way, either starting a word originating as a jargony term and evolving into a human English word, or the other way around, where an English word can be co-opted and turned into jargon. So, these guys are staring at me like I'm completely insane, and they're asking the question I know, why the heck am I yammering on about language and jargon on this very lovely Skeptic Radio show? Well, the short answer, for me anyway, is that these concepts are incredibly important to the skeptic community. We're a group with a mandate of spreading a message and spreading a message of critical thinking. And we have more reasons than most to be really aware of the powers and the pitfalls of the words that are used around us and that we're interpreting, as well as those that we're using ourselves. So in my limited experience, there are basically two jargon communities that are especially pertinent to those in the skeptic community. One is jargon within the skeptical community itself, which, as someone who recently approached this community, is very, very, very prevalent, let me tell you. And one is jargon in the scientific community, which I have been accustomed to for a little bit longer. So my very wise radio co-host, Dawn, suggested that I break these two topics into two separate discussions, and not being one to ignore advice from older and wiser people than myself, decided to take this advice. So, as I mentioned before, today we'll be talking about mostly jargon in the scientific community and issues with language in science communication.
I think it's important at this point that I should mention the amplitude of this didactic audiology of this trinary electromagnetic terrestrial localized limited transmission has reached a penumbral plateau, risking cerebral magnetic biochemical instability. And that could be a risk to us all.
Oh, Don, did you make that up yourself?
I use big words. I'm a big boy now. Jargon. What is jargon?
Well, that can be sort of a very extreme example. Unfortunately, it's not that much more extreme than what you might find in scientific communications that you might be reading. So, for example, I literally picked some random articles from a literature search in PubMed using the word evolution. And I got a couple of paragraphs. So, one example... What? That's not jargon. That's no. An accident.
Is there an iPhone doctor in the house?
So one example, in patient 14, site 16093 in cancerous tissue is homoplastic C, while in paracancerous normal and distant normal tissue, this shifts to be heteroplastic as CT. So that was one article. Another sentence, we transfected plasmids expressing each of 10 parallel GP120 genes into CHOK1 cells and analyzed the resulting secreted proteins on dot plots for their ability to bind anti-His tag MAB.
So when I read your little example there, I was like, I'm going, paracancers, ooh, that's a cool term. And I went to find the definition of paracancers. There is no definition of the word paracancerous. The only thing I could figure out, which I did, was the prefix para means near. So in the context, I could say, oh, obviously it means near the cancer cell that are normal. But a lot of this jargon, which I think adds to the whole complexity of this, if there is no dictionary of jargon, there is usually communal understanding.
Exactly, which is actually much the way the same way that other language evolves. I mean, the dictionary is adding new words every year, and every year someone comes up with a newspaper article, oh my goodness, look at the word they added to the dictionary. But it's exactly the way that language evolves. People start using it, they start using it in a consistent context to mean a specific thing, and the dictionary definition follows from that. Jargon is no exception. So you're absolutely right. Many of the words, especially the very specific words in very sort of compartmentalized scientific communities, are going to develop and really be incomprehensible and completely inaccessible to people outside of that community, because there's not even a way they can access it short of going back through the literature searching for that specific word.
But doesn't scientists and the field of science itself require sort of advanced terminology to explain things? I mean, they can't say, you know, you got an ooey ooey bow wow on your arm and you need to get a needle to make it go bye-bye, right?
It's really hard to make that tone in typing. You have to make the font really small.
That's why they have emoticons. Little crying eyes next to a picture of a needle.
I put those in all my manuscripts. But no, you're absolutely right in that there is a very defined purpose for scientific jargon, especially when it's used properly. And that is that although things can sound really convoluted and can sound really sort of obtuse, The language that's being used is absolutely tailored to be the most specific, precise, and concise language possible for that subject.
Sometimes. I'm going to go back to the paracancerous, because again, I thought, because in the phrase that you gave, and I'm sure there was a blog about this eventually, in there it mentions that the paracancerous normal cells and distant normal cells were something. And I'm going, well, I know distance is a proper thing. And paracancer just means near. So why don't they just say near and distant? Why do they have to create this entire term paracancerous, which seems to me verbiage for the sake of verbiage?
I suspect that in this context, just reading the sentence, so I am not a cancer researcher, and actually one of the reasons that I read these particular sentences is I don't understand them either. And I suspect that paracancerous actually doesn't mean sort of beside cancer so much as borderline cancerous, or expressing certain proteins that are characteristic of cancer but not expressing other things that define the cell as cancer. And so given that, so that's exactly one of the examples of things where the word sounds like you understand it, but the specific meaning in the community that's understood that uses this jargon is something that might be related to that, but isn't the same. And so you think you understand, but you don't, and that can be a dangerous thing.
Because I know one of the things that often comes up in the philosophical community is a definition of a word. And I mean, something like free will, which you think is an obvious meaning.
Oh, that's so easy.
Right. But I mean, within a philosophical paper, a author may use three or four different definitions of that one term and assumes to a certain degree that everyone reading it will understand the shifts, assuming he understands he made the shifts himself. How do scientists prevent this? Ethan worships science. I think science is awful damn good. How do scientists prevent this sort of verbal malaise, a seepage from one definition to another? They're still using the same term, but they may not mean it in the same way.
So this actually hasn't been, and again, I mean, I haven't been a career scientist for that long, but in my experience, it hasn't really been a problem in the scientific community for the most part, because the words are specifically designed to have one precise meaning. There doesn't tend to be a lot of bleed to sideways meanings, which is why you get a bunch of words that sound like they're the same, that they might mean the same thing, and actually mean very subtle differences between all those things, so that each one does have a specific meaning. It's kind of like, this is probably a horrible example, but the Inuit having a bunch of words for snow, which you're giving me a look, so I feel it might not be true. But
we'll pretend.
If it were true, it's a good example, where the the meaning of each word really does describe something that is more precise than a more general word might mean, and the different words aren't synonyms of each other.
But how do they get that level of precision when there doesn't seem to be a similar repository of definitions that you do get, like, say, the Oxford English Dictionary? I mean, there is no real equivalent of the Cancerous Dictionary of Terms or anything, right?
No, not really. It sort of is the building of the literature. But I would argue that it's sort of near pathologic anality when writing manuscripts, and supervisors that keep a really tight thumb on things.
Well, let's jump to the power of jargon to alienate. Where does that come to play?
So one of the problems with scientific jargon, so as we sort of talked about, it's actually really, really, really crucial for scientific communication, because you absolutely need those very precise, very concise, even though they might not seem, definitions for words, so that you're able to, in the fewest words possible, describe your research to people who are in the know, who don't need all that background, without sort of writing things that are theses long every time you want to communicate with another scientist. However, this is a big problem, when it arises often when research scientists use the same language or only slightly altered language to talk to people that are outside of their field of research. So this can be anywhere from sort of a science blog-wise journalist to the audience at a community meeting, or even as close as the guy who works across the hall from you but isn't involved in your exact research. You really need to alter your language for each of those audiences. So if a scientist doesn't know how to or doesn't choose to adapt their language to the level of knowledge of their audience, it can be really difficult to get the truth from the horse's mouth, so to speak, which is something that as critical thinkers we should all be trying to do. So it can be a major problem for society at large, because near and dear to the hearts of skeptics the world over, again, we really want to find that truth from the source. So for effective decision-making, and arguably more important, policy-making, the public needs to have this accurate information. But for many issues, it's the research sciences themselves who are accustomed to using the type of jargon-filled language or overly conservative language when they're communicating to other scientists, and they use this to communicate to the public. So this usually, as Ethan was mentioning, sort of tongue-in-cheek at the beginning of the show, isn't done on purpose. There's no sort of nefarious plot of the scientists to keep their work from other people. They just don't know how to do it. And it really becomes a major problem.
So you get one of those instances where... sorry, I lost my thought now, because Ethan was going to speak at the same time I was.
Sorry, Don. But I was going to suggest that there's also sort of a very sort of negative aspect of this, is that it actually can create sort of an adversarial relationship between science and the public. You get these sort of ivory tower scientists in white lab coats who come in and say something really complicated, intelligent sounding, and you have the average person who has no idea what they just said and are expected to change their way of life because some scientist says that, oh, it's getting warmer out and now the ice is going to melt and it's going to flood the planet. But they don't say it like that.
Or yeah. Worse yet, to now that I remember what it was I was going to say, is you get a scientist who will sit there and say, for example, that in recent experiments we had a noticeable increase of energy in the cerebral hemisphere near a cell phone. And people say, oh, you know, electromagnetic energy is invading your... I mean, like the scientists, what they said in the context of their paper was very specific, very accurate, right? There was a marked increase in blood flow there, and they just said energy because that's the term they used. But when that gets released to the public, it can be reinterpreted. Or if someone says, and I think this is really going with what Ethan was saying, it says, so are you telling me that global warming will mean definitely next year will be 20 degrees hotter than today? And they go, well, no, I can't say definitely, because we deal with probabilities and we know that in the long run it's going to be a significant increase. And you say, oh, so you don't know for sure? He said, well, no, I don't know for sure, but all the evidence is pointing to that. Ah, therefore you're just making it up.
Well, I think the last point, although it's sort of related to what I want to say, is sort of getting away from the idea of jargon. But yeah, more as opposed to an adversarial relationship, I think it creates, again, this alienation and just distance between the scientific community and the public. It's really, really, really boring to hear people talk in language that you don't understand. And no matter how important or actually exciting that truth might be, if it's couched in these incomprehensible terms and really conservative language, yeah, maybe, might, suggest that, then it's just disinteresting to people who are listening. It's boring. So you're sort of creating this chasm between the truth and those that would absorb it by that language that you're using. So, and related, I think, a little bit more related to what Don was talking about, another issue that's sort of separate from this unintentional alienation of science from the public by use of jargon, you get a misuse or a misinterpretation of the jargony terms that then all of a sudden make it sound really sexy. So this is distinctly unboring and tends to result in a very profound twisting of the truth. So most of the time, and I mean, you got your odd sort of evil scientists, for lack of a better word, but most scientists don't actually like to lie about their results and go to great lengths to make sure that they are not stretching the results of their experiments, which is what results in the boring language. However, there are people that co-opt either scientific jargon, scientific results, or both to make things sound really interesting. And this is, of course, the sort of area of the pseudoscientists and the proponents of pseudoscience. So anyone who has listened to this show before has definitely heard either Ethan or Don read examples of explanations of pseudoscientific concepts that are, again, couched in this profoundly scientific language. I remember last week someone was describing the biomeridian treatment as sublingual, which means under your tongue, which is clearly not what they meant. But, you know, it sounds sexy. But in many cases, the words they use just are just completely incomprehensible to the audience, and can actually be incomprehensible to those spouting them out.
Actually, and I think you've leaped on one of the important things, that although we tend to jump upon the malicious practitioners of woo and bad science and all that, a number of them are genuine believers that they see some sort of, you know, be it a placebo effect or be it some other genuine sort of weirdness in the universe, and they want to understand it. So they go and they use these terms thinking they're genuinely grabbing some grasp of understanding, but because the terms aren't appropriate or it's being misused or misapplied, that they are themselves somewhat diluted in their own verbal salad.
And I would actually think that the proponents of people that use sort of mushier language are more genuine. This co-opting of scientific terms that may or may not have anything to do with what you're talking about, to me seems a lot more disingenuous just because of the amazing power of that language to convince other people that they know what they're talking about. And I think that rather than trying to sort of engender some kind of understanding of the topic, more often than not, I see that type of language being used in order to, on purpose, confuse people into just saying, okay, that's legitimate, so whatever else they're saying must be legitimate. They sound like they have credentials, sounds good. So I find the use of that type of language inappropriately very disingenuous.
It's sort of the difference between someone like Deepak Chopra using quantum entanglement and all these other pseudo terms for his nonsense versus someone at like a mind body soul expo saying, you know, the energy will cure you.
Exactly. Something. These more nebulous terms, you know, they're not purporting to understand more than they actually do, and so it's not as misleading. It's easier to judge for yourself whether or not that has some scientific backing, whereas you start throwing these scientific jargon terms at something and it becomes very dangerous.
Exactly. So what should we do about this jargon?
Well, I think everyone should go out and get themselves several advanced degrees.
Okay.
You know, I've learned that writing a thesis is probably the easiest way to become entirely saturated in academic jargon. However, the most important thing for people to do, including myself, is to be able to recognize jargon when you see it or when you hear it. So this does sound pretty trivial in the context of this conversation, and sometimes it really is. So for example, sometimes you hear things in science that sound a heck of a lot more like Greek or random strings of letters than English words.
Paracancerous.
Paracancerous. Para, is that Greek? Roman? Don't know. In any case, so there's a good chance that that's a specialized piece of scientific terminology. And when you're reading it in something that is sort of making you go, and wondering whether or not that science, that might be a cue to start really paying attention to what you're reading. However, there are also, as we were saying, times when people actually will co-opt these terms that already have English definitions, and those can be harder to spot. But basically, if you're reading something or listening to something and a word sounds like it's really carrying the crux of the argument, but you're not 100% sure how you would even define it in that context, that's a cue to look for some more information. And I would like to stress that I don't think it's a bad thing or something to be embarrassed about ever to look for more meaning and a definition of the words that are being used to you, because if you're not understanding it, the fault isn't yours. It's the person that's communicating to you.
And we should be aware, too, that if you do a Google search, you may not actually find the appropriate definition of a term, because again, a lot of the people out there who are trying to misuse the term will actually tend to have more web pages that are sort of saying, here is the truth, as opposed to the scientists who are only worried about their footnoted journal papers that they have that tend to be not in the general public domain.
Absolutely. And as skeptics, I think it's important to be aware that a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. And so those who understand half of the truth really well and the other half not well at all can really disseminate into the public and really cause a lot of ruckus.
Well, we'll have to keep our eye out for this evil jargon, though.
You know, in an odd way, sorry, you've just did a homeopathic maxim. If a little bit of knowledge is dangerous, absolutely no knowledge must be much more dangerous.
Which I think properly is diluted and memorized by water. Well, why don't we go on to our skeptical highlights as we are wrapping up for today. I have a great one here, and it is the Beast of the Bottomless Lake DVD release party and screening. It's a film produced by a friend of the show, Kennedy Goodkey, and features David Nickel as Dr. Paul Morin, who's on a quest to find the Ogopogo. The screening is at the Denman Cinemas on 1779 Cosmox Street, Vancouver, BC, at 6:30 p.m. on Friday, July 15. Tickets are $15 in advance. They are not available at the door. You have to purchase either online, and we'll have a link for that on the show notes, or earlier in the day at the box office. So check it out. It's going to be your last chance to see it on the big screen and pick up a DVD. And I hear it is quite awesome.
I have two highlights. One, because a particular listener of ours doesn't like me using the term nuclear, I have made it a pledge to actually no longer use the N-word to refer to it, but to use atomic or fission or fusion. Hopefully then no one will have to yell at me for not pronouncing words right. But my genuine...
fabricating words.
I like making words up. English, we just talked about this. English is an evolving language. If you use a term and enough people pick it up, it's a genuine word.
I'm so disorientated.
So, speaking of highlights, I have a movie highlight here. It's called The Ledge. This is a new film with Charlie Hunnam, who plays an atheist named Galvin, who is about to kill himself because of a dispute with a Christian villain named Joe, played by Patrick Wilson. The director of this particular movie, Matthew Chapman, says, although books have put atheists into the intellectual mainstream, The Ledge is the first Hollywood drama to target a broader movie-going public with openly atheist hero in a big production, sort of A-list star movie. He says this is unprecedented. From the clips that I saw, and I'm not going to tell you too much about it because it's a good movie all on unto itself, but atheism is a major theme in the movie. The religious hypocrisy is a major theme in the movie. And I thought it was cool. You can get it via iTunes or at Sundance Now. I have been trying to track down a release here in Vancouver, and I haven't, although I understand it's been released in Europe, among other areas, New York, L.A., not Canada.
Selected cities only, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening, and remember to tune in next week, and I will tell you all about TAM-9, the amazing meeting in Las Vegas.
Isn't it TAM-9 from outer space?
It is, but I say it in Las Vegas because that's where it is.
Oh. And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
This is Jenna saying, remember, the real world is amazing.
Yes, it is. Tune in next week.